Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, July 13th, 2023. A lot of topics to cover tonight, and thank you for listening. You know, I talk to people because of the water filter business, and almost everybody says, you know, I've been listening to you for, you know, and they'll say the first time they heard me back in the 90s with Art Bell or some other show, or they've been following my show or something. So there's a lot of long-time listeners out there. So I must be doing something right because people stop and they, you know, the one thing they always say is that I talk about things that they don't hear anyplace else. And also I think I straighten out a lot of the thinking that people have. I talk about things and I have a pretty good perspective of the world. Being both a scientist, therefore a realist, and having been around the block and having been in some pretty high places and some pretty low places. Let me tell you, I've been in some of the top places on the planet and some of the, let's just put it, in some third world countries, some pretty rough places that most people would not be able to stomach. So anyway, and every place in between. So thank you for listening, and I hope to be here many decades into the future because there's no shortage. Doing science commentary is kind of like doing political comedy. There's never any lack of topics. It's just what's the most important thing pending at this point in time. So just to remind you, one of the very important things in the world of science, is that you have to understand the tier level of science, which I don't know anybody else that's defined this or seen it or understood it like I have, seen it at all levels and experienced it, and then turn around and tell it to the public. And that is that there's a tier one science that sits above, like most people think that the NASA scientists or the one that you see in the news or people like Carl Sagan or Neil deGrasse Tyson, that these are somehow the top scientists. No. Those are tier two scientists. In fact, I would say somebody like Carl Sagan or Neil deGrasse Tyson are borderline tier two, tier three, because they're spokespersons, they're outreach persons. They're people that really, they're not what you would call hardened scientists. They don't do hard science. They talk science. It's a talky-talky thing. And they can talk about putting it all in order, black holes and Big Bang and, you know, whatever else they chatter about. But they're, anyway, the Tier 2 scientists might be the ones that are hard at work at NASA. And I'm not talking about the engineers. No, I'm talking about people with PhDs in astrophysics, astronomy, and space science. And so they're kind of in a group all themselves. The one thing I always say is the people I really, really admire at NASA, the unsung heroes, are the engineers that make everything work. They build and design the spacecraft. They guide them through planetary maze and do amazing, amazing things with these spacecraft, like the Juno spacecraft or the Galileo, which orbits Jupiter in that just unbelievable radiation field. And these guys know what you have to do to make something last, because your average radio electronics, that if you took your computer or any other piece of electronics, your telephone out in the region of Jupiter, it wouldn't last a New York second. So the engineers who build that stuff, and I've been in that world of telecommunications and electronics and rad-hardened electronics, etc. I've been in that world. I worked in it. But those are the guys that I, hats off, you know, congratulations. Those are the unsung heroes. But the tier two scientists, the guys that parade around to go around on what I call scientific vacations, etc., or get their name in lights, those are not tier one scientists. The real scientists, the tier one scientists, let's just say this, though, including about tier two science, they don't know anything about tier one science. They may have been in the same room with a Tier 1 scientist, but never knew it. That's the closest they may have been. But they have no clue that what they're doing, the research they're doing, is intentionally false. It's they're promoted for creating false science, and that's what dribbles down to the public through the news media, the glossy science news media, the internet news media, things like National Geographic or the Discovery Channel or History Channel, wherever it shows up. The Tier 2 science is what dribbles down to the public. But anyway, the Tier 1 science, you never see them, you never see their names, you don't know who they are. I've met a lot of them myself just in my being around the block in science. Tier 2 scientists in general have no clue that that exists or what's going on there, or that the science there is totally, totally different than anything you're going to see in the public domain. Then there's the Tier 3 scientists, which are, you might say, university professors who just teach, people who are concentrating on teaching or teaching in high school or something like that. And they just, another term for them is textbook repeaters or textbook geniuses, I call them sometimes. And then there's a Tier 4, which is outreach people. And I classify them in a category below the other ones because it's a, you know, they're kind of Tier 2 scientists, but all they do is go out there and pound the pavement and make NASA look good and everything gee whiz. Or they might be news reporters in the news media, and they might have a degree from some university in journalism with a major, with a minor in scientific journalism or something. You know, and those are the Tier 4 levels of science, the glossy internet or the maybe nice glossy YouTube channel, etc. Anyway, okay. So just to clarify that so people understand, I think that's very important to understand that. And so when I come on this show, you get a perspective from somebody who's been at Tier 1 levels, understands it, and understands real science and how the universe really works, etc. Anyway, here's an interesting story. In 1992, there was a discovery in China, 2,000-year-old caves. And now where they get this 2,000-year-old bit is beyond me. But anyway, a million cubic meters of rock was dug out of this. And these go on, they're extensive, a series of caves. They're in the Longju region. They're called the Longju Caves in China, but nobody knows who built them. There's no record of them. There's no there's no reference to them in history of any kind. And they're getting a bit of airtime now, even though, like I say, they were discovered in 1992. And there are other caves that people have been talking about on radio shows and things like that. But this cave is very interesting because there's very much Chinese people in the glyphs, etc., the petroglyphs that are on the walls. But look this up sometime, and just a very interesting story, and look at some of the videos and things that people are posting. Another quick story here. A Canadian company is building dirigibles, and they're doing these as a method of moving cargo. Now, they can move the huge amounts of tonnage with these dirigibles. They're 660 feet long, so that's about, they say, about 200 meters long. And they're planning on building in the next 10 years about 150 of these. So that is it's for transportation of goods. Now back in the good old pre-World War II days, the Germans were very big on dirigibles. There was a massive amount. In fact, in a lot of the old video clips, footage of movie footage, this is back with the, you know, black and white footage, pre-World War II footage, they showed the dirigibles coming into Manhattan Island in New York City, or they may have gone to Argentina, and there was regular transportation, but these were luxury liners, mind you. The people that paid for these dirigible rides around the world paid a lot of money. They were rich people. It was like the Titanic of transportation. Very comfortable, no turbulence, and just, you know, a very low velocity, and were, you know, a few hundred people at a time. So it would be the equivalent. And these people were on these things for quite a period of time, like a week or two potentially, while they were being moved from one continent to the other one. So the technology is well known. It's very old. It's very tried and true. And the thing that kind of put a damper on this was the Hindenburg, of course, the famous fire of the Hindenburg. And then, you know, many people died unbelievably. There were actually people who lived through that. And it caught, I forget all the details, but it caught on fire and burned. And of course, the fuel or the gas inside was hydrogen. Helium is getting harder and harder to find. So hydrogen will be the gas of choice, I'm sure, for any future dirigible companies, with the fact that helium, and additionally, hydrogen has much better lifting power. You can it'll carry a much bigger load with hydrogen gas, and so people may say, well, it's not safe, but handled properly, hydrogen is the gas of choice. There's no question about it. It's just that you have to make sure you don't have any sparks or fires or things like that around. So anyway, that's under development right now. They've actually tested the first one. And so I just find this is amazing because I myself am very interested in dirigible technology. It's part of my movement into hydrogen and the production of hydrogen, and that's one of the applications. And you can scale this down. What's really interesting is you can scale this down so you can imagine an inflatable airplane, that will literally take off vertically or land vertically and carry, you know, just like a small twin-engine aircraft, which the majority of fuel that is used is in creating the lift. In other words, you have to make the airplane go fast. And to do that, you need a lot of power because there's a lot of wind resistance. And with a dirigible, you don't have a lot of wind resistance, and the lift is provided by the gas in the enclosed container. So it's a tremendous saving on fuel is what you get out of this. So the amount of energy that it takes to move one of these dirigibles is very low. It's kind of like the concept back in the post-World War II days, the early development of the trans-Pacific flights. In fact, the oldest airline in the world is Hawaiian Air. It's still in existence, still flying. And I've known people that were even pilots for them and flew for decades and decades as pilots for Hawaiian Air. But they developed the flying boat, basically, it was called. And these were four-engine planes that could take off from, like, Los Angeles and fly to Hawaii with a plane load of people. And they would land on the water, so you did not need a runway, was the beauty of these. And, the Spruce Goose was Howard Hughes' contribution to that. He just wanted to make the biggest plane that was ever built. He flew it once, and now it's a museum sitting, you know, on the shoreline. But the concept is that at low velocity, you have very low wind resistance, and so the energy that it takes, and if you have the properly designed airfoils and wings, then it takes very little energy to move those. Very much different than a modern-day jet, which goes up to high altitude, and the dirigibles don't go up to high altitudes necessarily, but The modern jet is running at about, say, 35,000 feet altitude and moving at 4 to 6 to maybe even as much as 700 miles an hour. And so that takes a lot of power to make that plane move that fast. And of course, the advantage is you can go from New York to Paris in a few hours, you know, it's more than a few hours. But there's a cost to that. There's a cost of energy, and of course, this airplane, which is a pretty solid piece of machinery, as opposed to a dirigible, which couldn't go very fast at all, because you know you certainly couldn't go 600 miles an hour in a dirigible. I'm not sure what top speed on a dirigible is, but you know it's probably about 30, 40, 50, maybe not even 50 miles an hour, but they're very aerodynamic though. At a low speed, the air just slides around them. And of course, when you're in any kind of situation, whether it's a boat or an airplane or a car or whatever, it's the distortion of the air and then the excess. For example, if you're in a boat, the best example is in a boat. You go down, you have the water resistance, of course, but then you make a wave, and the boat makes a wave, and so the best designed boat is one that makes no wave, like a double-ender, where the water comes around and comes back together, and there's really no wake. That's why a powerboat consumes a lot of energy, because you got a flat back and typically, and it raises it up, and there's a big wave that comes off the back of the boat. Well, that's takes energy to make that wave. Whereas a dirigible going at relatively low velocity, and no, you don't have to have the high velocity and the aerodynamic lift of the wings to keep it up in the air. It's just floating there. So a dirigible is very economical. So anyway, back to the original story, this Canadian company is now in the process, and they're very well funded, I understand, in the process of starting to build 150, and I suspect that that number would actually increase, because when you look at, like, say, if you take a company like Boeing or Airbus that builds airplanes for the commercial market, there are, you know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of these in service, and of course many more that they built. And the airline industry is just one of the most dynamic and progressive industries that there is. You have two big corporations like Airbus and Boeing that are competing against each other, making bigger, more efficient, on and on and on. Okay. Anyway, enough of that. I would love to talk about the back in the old sailing days and the clipper ship days as those boats got really big, because one of my pet hobbies throughout my life has been boat building. I'm very interested in especially the older wooden boats. It's kind of the people that are interested in wooden boats, if you know any, they're kind of crazy. You know, they're kind of crazy about their boat. The fanatics, let's put it that way, you know, in all of the different types of structure, and I studied boat design and not only boat design, but boat construction when you're dealing with wood. And as you get up to bigger and bigger boats, and the big ones like the clipper ships, that's pretty amazing technology. Anyway, okay, going back, here's a little story. I'll quick throw this in. NASA had a project. It's called the X-57 Maxwell, an electric airplane, truly an electric airplane, canceled the program this last week. And it's a program that's been with them for a very long time. Now, the X-57 Maxwell, the concept was that you had this high wing. Is like there's the high winged airplane where you have the wings on top of the fuselage. That's what this is. And then it had two big propellers at the end of the wings, and then many little propellers and engines along the wing. And so the idea of the little propellers was to, and they're in front of the wing, by the way. So the idea is that they would throw air over the wing, increase the airflow, etc., and provide much more lift for takeoff. And then once it was up to cruising altitude, the little engines would shut down and just the big engines would keep it going, because typically at takeoff, you need a lot more thrust. So instead of having engines, like say on a two-engine jet plane, that those engines go from very high thrust at takeoff to much lower thrust at cruising altitude. And it's all done by these two engines that are exactly the same, one on each side of the plane. The idea of the Maxwell is that you added this extra weight for this high-powered thrust during takeoff, and then you just shut those engines down, and they became part of the payload, actually. But anyway, for whatever it's worth, they shut the program down this past week. And yeah, I just think it's, you see a program like that in a government agency, and it very rarely do they have the ability to move like a company, like a private company that's funded and has very different objectives, very different method of methodology for dealing with solving the problem, etc. Here's something that I saw in a video clip. And I'll give the reference here. It was on the Joe Rogan show. But anyway, they were talking about this bear that lived up in the Bering Straits back in the day when supposedly man was crossing the Bering Strait to populate what we call the Western Hemisphere now, the Americas. And that story doesn't hold water on 10 counts. As soon as you peel back the onion layer, the first onion layer, that story falls apart. It couldn't possibly be true. Because, well, for one thing, there were civilizations, advanced civilizations, in the Western Hemisphere long before the alleged crossing of the Bering Strait by nomadic tribes, supposedly following reindeer herds or something. But this was interesting. Rogan was talking with some guest about a bear that was many, many times bigger than the current polar bear. And they were strictly carnivorous. And so the whole issue with polar bears, if you're up in fact, I've been in areas where there are polar bears. I've been up in, say, Ontario in the middle of winter when the polar bears come down because they're hungry. They're looking for food. And people there live in very, very poorly built. I wouldn't say they're poorly built, but they're not something that would keep a polar bear out. If a polar bear wants to get into a house up in, I won't say any towns in specifically, but the people live in their houses with loaded high-powered rifles, because if, you know, you're cooking, and a bear gets a wind of that, and they happen to be in the area. Of course, you're dealing in a little town, and the polar bears, when they come down into the area, are hunting for other kinds of animals, like deer or caribou or moose or something like that. But they're dealing with big animals. But if they happen to wander into one of these little towns, the very low probability, but it does happen, then one of those bears can easily just rip the side off of a house. And they're very little houses. I've been in these, and they're extremely small. They're, and of course they have to heat these in severe, severe winter conditions. That's when I was happened to be living outside myself in those conditions where I literally didn't have housing. I didn't have a tent. I didn't have a roof over my head. I literally lived outside from about May of that year up into about February, when I finally decided to come back to society, entered the workforce, and became a productive engineer. And that was after the mishap that I had at Cornell University, the hallowed halls of Cornell, you know, where all kinds of... Anyway, I'm not going to go there tonight. But you know that story. if you know anything about me. But anyway, I was up in this region in central Ontario, and these polar bears would come down, and you had to be very careful because and you couldn't bring down a polar bear with like one shot from a serious high-powered rifle. It would be many, many shots, and hopefully you could stop the bear before he ate everybody in the house. But the thing that Rogan was talking about was this bear that was many, many times bigger than the current polar bear and were carnivorous. So the idea that these herds of people were crossing the Bering Strait on foot and just kind of meandering across there with this herds of these massive bear there who are carnivorous that probably could eat a person or two for a snack, kind of puts the damper on that concept. But like I say, that idea doesn't hold water because if you look at the racial figures, the genetics of the North American, the Central American, the Mexican, these regions that we call Mexico now or South America, if you look at the genetics of these people, they have nothing to do with the people that would have been in China, Mongolia, etc. And so there's this totally disjoint genetics of the people who are in the Americas. So that explanation for a dozen reasons does not hold water. But I like that, and so I thought I'd repeat it here on the air, that, the polar bears would have greatly inhibited herds of people, you would call them nomads, trying to trek across the Bering Strait following reindeer for their food and somehow populating what we call the Western Hemisphere today. Okay, here's an interesting story. And by the way, let me quick get this in before I forget about it. UPS, my water filter stuff, the MR5, the whole house water filter, and the accessories, etc. And most of the stuff that I ship goes out UPS. A couple little things go out postal, but very minor amount of stuff goes out U.S. postal. The majority of what I ship is UPS, but UPS happens to be in the midst of a pretty serious negotiation. The Teamster Union walked out the other day of the negotiations. I'm not sure if they're back at the negotiating table again. But anyway, that's very typical, though, and they have till the end of the month to rectify their differences and get a contract signed. But, of course, a lot of times a president would step in a case like this. But since there's nobody running the ship called the United States, then the union and the workers, hundreds of thousands of these UPS workers could actually go on strike. So the point is, if you want to order something from me, do it now. While we still got UPS working, they're still moving packages, etc. And so let's get this, get your orders in right now. And along with that, it just happens to be at this very moment, we are moving my warehouse. I'm upgrading my warehouse situation. And to do that, I have to move some of the stock that I have out. And for that reason, there's a very big sale on the MR5. It's called the Best Deal Package, where you get the MR5 whole house water filter, unlike anything on the market. The UV sterilizer, it's the final filter, it's a UV sterilizer, the best on the market, and the extra set of filter elements for the MR5. It's called the Best Deal Package. It's what 99% of the people purchase when they come to my webpage, buying the whole house water filter. And that is on sale for a ridiculously low price right now. And we have a set amount of stock. And when that stock is gone, then the prices are going to go back up. They're typically $2,366. That's that package on my webpage. And so go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, and check it out and partake in that. But like I say, another big reason for acting now, whether you're buying a 10-pack of the gravity filter elements, replacement elements for gravity filter, or a sink filter or whatever, is that UPS may not be shipping after July 31st. And believe me, there's, you know, you'd say, well, it just ship FedEx. No, FedEx and Postal cannot, I repeat, cannot pick up the slack for the company called UPS. They have about, from what I understand, about 40% of the shipping market. And of course, they do international. I don't know if the international UPS is on strike, but it hardly matters because once it gets off the boat or airplane or whatever from an international shipment, it ultimately has to get on a truck to go out to the final destination. So anyway, two things, two big reasons for acting right now. The warehouse moving sale on my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, the MR5 best deal is on sale. And the other stuff is not on sale. That's not an issue as far as moving to the new warehouse. What is at issue is some of the stock we have with MR5s. So that stuff, like I say, there's a set number of units we're going to sell at a very good price. And so go there and check it out. And by the way, I've canceled the use of pretty much all the coupons that are out there. There's a couple places where there's a coupon code that still could be used. But as far as all the other coupon codes, they're no longer in existence because the prices are set the way they're set. And we're not going to have any other discounts. Okay, so enough of that. But go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, and check out that sale. Get your MR5 whole house water filter package today, and we'll get it shipped right away. We have them in stock, ready to roll. And before the UPS strike occurs, the 1st of August, get those orders in. Okay, a quick trip back into yesteryear over legacy computing. Now, I grew up, let me just give you a little history of my life in electronics. Of course, I was a physics major, and as a sophomore, we started electronics. I had my first electronics course, and we used tubes. We were actually using tubes for our experiments. That's back in the good old 60s. And so transistors were just coming into use. And so we learned about tubes, and very important to understand how tubes worked, the tube electronics, because it transitioned into transistors very nicely. And back in those days, the transistor was a little round can with a silicone deposit in the can, and then three little wires sticking out, and the diodes had two little wires sticking out. And you would build a circuit board with little resistors, with color-coded resistors, etc. And you could make logic circuits and amplification circuits and feedback amplifiers, all kinds of things, power converters. But anyway, that's back in the legacy days of computing, and you had IBM and Control Data and Honeywell. Those were the big names in computing back then. And they built mainframe computers, where the mainframe computer sat in a room that was highly guarded. It usually was in the basement of a building with a lot of cement around it, and only designated people could go into that room. But out from that came telecommunications, and you had things like the IBM 270, 370 terminals, and these were dumb terminals in their early versions, where if you typed the letter M, for example, that signal would go up to the mainframe. The mainframe would put it in the memory in your little memory area, send back a command that would put a M on your screen. That's how primitive it was. But the mainframe was doing all of this. And my specialty was in encryption and in doing the telecommunications as these systems grew. Okay, so back in the earliest days of computing in the legacy IBM mainframe days, the main computer did everything. And you had what you call dumb terminals. Little by little, a little bit of memory, a little bit of computing power went into the remote terminals. And then people finally, as memories developed, as logic circuits developed, they would put more and more because it didn't make much sense to send a letter off to the mainframe computer. And then the mainframe computer had to send back a signal to your screen. Why couldn't you just do that on your terminal? And so that was the next step. And then you got editors, primitive editors, where you could do editing and control and erase things. And in your terminal, and then it grew into from central processing where everything was done at the mainframe into distributed computing where some of it was offloaded out into these more increasingly more intelligent devices that were like, they looked like a computer today, although they had a typical old-fashioned TV screen anyway, if you ever saw those or sat in front of one. But as time went on, more and more computing power went into the remote terminal to the point where the remote terminal could actually be unplugged from the mainframe, do a bit of work, and then get plugged back into the mainframe to interact with the mainframe on a higher level. And so that brought in the advent of the personal computer. And this is something, by the way, that IBM and Control Data did not see coming. Kodak was another big company in computing back in the early days. And Kodak had the chemical film industry. They made all the film. They were the biggest companies. There were some European companies also at the time. But Kodak was the one that had the worldwide concession on silver halide film, the old 35 millimeter and other forms that a lot of the early films were shot on, like the movie 2001, for example, was shot on reverse ektachrome film reversed into a positive, give those bright colors, etc. So at any rate, but the reason I mentioned Kodak is they did not see the digital revolution coming. Now, you cannot buy a camera today with film in it. Maybe you can. I don't know. But it takes processing, and there's, you know, you may have 12 pictures on a roll. So Kodak didn't see the digital revolution coming. IBM did not see the digital revolution coming in cameras and in photography and in screens and in computing and personal computers. They did not see that coming. Okay, so at any rate, more and more, of course, once the personal computer broke away from the mainframe, I knew some people, not real good friends of mine, but acquaintances, that became incredibly wealthy. There's a guy, a tremendous businessman. He was not a computer guy at all, but he started hiring graduates out of computing schools to convert legacy computers into distributed computers with PCs. Made a fortune, absolute fortune, converting legacy computing to distributed computing systems. And at that time, all of the big businesses were getting away from their legacy computers and downsizing. Financially, it cost a lot less money to run these distributed systems. But at any rate, so all of the horsepower and the memory and everything went outbound into personal computers. And it was held in personal computers. So you got completely away from the idea of the mainframe computer in a computer room controlling everything. Now we are getting back to that point where, say, a modern phone, if you get a 5G phone, it does not have much computing capability in it. It's very fast for the things that it does. But all it's doing is it's putting stuff up on the screen. And all your memory and everything that's, you have a little bit of memory in a phone, in the phone itself. Now this is a 5G phone compared to a 4G phone, which had more memory, more storage capability. And now everything is cloud-based. All of your data, all of your contacts, all of your photos, all of your videos, everything in your phone is loaded up to some Google memory base someplace, and if you, say, lose your phone, The only way you can recover, excuse me, that data is by going up to Google and having your phone, or they say you'd go get a new phone, your old one fell in the lake or something, so you got to go get a new phone. The only way to get back all your data is to go up into Google, and then you can access all your data, which is held there. So now it's come complete 180-degree full circle from the complete distributed memory processing, etc., back to a phone. The 5G phones are relatively stupid phones, where all of your data, all of your processing, a lot of your processing, and things like that. For example, say you have an application that does voice translation, very popular application today. Your data and your transaction with that system, with that application, is going out into the internet, being processed and being sent back to your phone. So we come 180 degrees back around the circle again, back to the point of almost where legacy computing, where everything is held in some kind of central database. But what's going on today is much more nefarious. It's not a single company that owns this legacy computer for its own personal processing. It's agencies that control all the data of everybody in the world. So your Facebook, your Instagram, Twitter, you know, everything is held in by these entities, the vast majority of which are owned by the CIA. That they went out, and when these companies succeeded, they broke through, they became successful, they became big, everybody joined their platform. And at that point, the CIA came in and said, okay, they converted some of their drug money into buying that those companies. So, all of the social media companies are controlled by CIA. And the NSF, you might say, oh, the NSF is in there too. Well, they're controlled by the CIA also. When it's the CIA is the police force of the World Bank. You've heard me say that before. Okay, so at any rate, just a quick note on that. And I lived through all of this. Like I say, when I was in college learning electronics, I taught electronics at the university level and as a course. I taught, of course, all kinds of courses, physics, mathematics. About 10 years of my career, I was a university teaching in the university, physics, mathematics, computer science, and astronomy. I actually taught astronomy for a few years also in one of the state college systems during my teaching career. But 25 years of my professional career was in the telecommunications electronics world, where I was a principal systems engineer for 10 years with a company that did IBM mainframe telecommunications. And then also I worked 15 years in a telecommunications company where I was with a elite group of professional engineers who managed national, international telecommunications services and systems, etc. And so it's something I happen to know quite a bit about. I've been on the ANSI different commissions specifying, you know, the Ethernet protocol, the 602 protocols. I was on those committees. So it's something that I have a bit of experience in. And so anyway, it's interesting to see from my perspective, my historical perspective, going back into electronics, post-World War II electronics, literally, up to the current age and how that has evolved. Okay, now on to my main science topic here. I'm going to talk a bit about artificial intelligence. And now this you're seeing all over. I just got a thing today in the email trying to sell me a package called Fusion. It's an advertising AI system that's supposed to be better than sliced bread, you know, the best thing since sliced bread type of thing. There are, for example, if you have any system at all, you might have Google. Ask Google is another AI system. Bing is another one. And there's many. They're just coming up like popcorn, popping up all over the place. Every place you look are AI systems. But what I want to talk to you about tonight is the fundamental failure of AI systems. What are the main reasons why AI systems will fail, ultimately? And they're going to become very popular. And by the way, artificial intelligence is not new. This is not the brand new spanking everybody, ooh, this is the growth of computers. This has come around, and there again, I go back decades and decades, you know, half of a century or better in this world. And so back in the, there was a time, probably in the 70s, they were called knowledge-based systems. And this is beginning, by the way, of Wikipedia. When Wikipedia finally emerged in the computer world a decade or two ago, whenever that emerged, it was supposed to be the thing where everybody put their knowledge into Wikipedia and it would be a knowledge base and it would be open, and that immediately got taken over by the CIA and controlled to the point now where everything is completely controlled in Wikipedia. And that's one of the downfalls of any AI system, is that as soon as it becomes important, as soon as it gains traction, it will be taken over and completely controlled by some nefarious group, whether it's the CIA or whether they're even going to be around anymore, who knows. The second problem with AI is called input. You have AI is a system of decision making, and they keep getting closer and closer to, they say, human being and human decision making. But everything requires input. Now, one of the odd things here is that Elon Musk, a couple of months ago, I announced this on my show, and of course, you probably heard it every place else, called up and with something like 6,000 leaders of companies around the world, had some kind of thing they wrote, open letter, stating that there should be a moratorium on any development of AI stuff for 6 months until people sit down and decide how this is going to be managed, because it's like a monster. It's like a Frankenstein computer monster that's growing. Nobody knows how to handle it. Nobody knows how to deal with it. And they certainly don't know where it's going, or are there legal ramifications, social ramifications, etc. And so they wanted to put a limit on this. But in the background, Elon Musk is putting up his Neuralink, which is 60,000 satellites going around the world, all grabbing information and being part of this neural network, and experimenting with brain plants in people, where you put a brain plant in, and that's your communication. It's called Neuralink. And it's another brainchild of ultra-rich Elon Musk. Now, I like some of the stuff he's doing. I'm pretty impressed. But this is one of the things that I think is just kind of, you know, to excuse the term, batshit crazy. The implications of putting chips in people's brains where they then are linked into this international neural network, and not only is it transmitting to these people, but they're sending information, you know, their thoughts or whatever. But anyway, the big failure point for AI systems is called input, because it only can have as much information as in terms of input that is actually physically put into the system. And, you know, the thing that is always underlies a knowledge-based system or an AI system, whatever you want to call it. And by the way, the knowledge-based systems went by the way of the dinosaur. They're no longer, they went away because they failed. They failed for all the reasons I'm about to tell you. They failed because, now just imagine today, in the 1970s, we're talking, you know, literally, you know, 50 years ago, knowledge-based systems where the computing was going to take over and everything. But can you imagine the world today, as we know it today, being operated from a knowledge-based system developed in the mid-1970s? Get real. I mean, seriously, get real. That is the problem with AI systems. Is, you know, an AI system developed today is going to be bogged down by everything that's put in today, and is it going to evolve along with all of the evolution of speech, of concepts, of the way people consider certain things, the public social view of different things is going to change, and it changes daily. It's like this society and culture we live in on planet Earth is changing constantly. In an AI system, the whole premise is that once you put all this information in, then it can calculate all future things, etc. But let me give you an example of how AI people think. Here's an example of the perfect world according to somebody in AI. You are AI driven. You are a member of the world AI community. You go to sleep at night. Your alarm clock is set by AI, a certain time to wake up in the morning. Your clothes are chosen for you, and the amount of time for you to put on your clothes is designated. And so you have to have your clothes on by a certain time. The coffee machine in the kitchen is going to make your morning coffee, so when you go down there, you don't have to waste time doing that. You walk out the door, your Uber comes by at exactly the right time, picks you up, takes you to where you stop off at McDonald's to get your McDonald's breakfast, which has already been cooked for you because they know you're going to arrive exactly at the designated time by the AI system. And so McDonald's knows this potentially weeks in advance, so it knows to have on hand enough product for you to have your little breakfast. You drive by the window in the Uber, they hand out you the breakfast, you get to work exactly on time, and then that Uber gets off to pick up somebody else. This is the perfect parsimonious world of AI. And these people glean over this. They just think this is the best thing, that it's the wonderful, magical world where everything operates perfectly. It's, you know, it's like that movie with Jim Carrey, you know, where he's Truman, and he's filmed his whole life, and he finally figures it out, and he escapes, you know. But anyway, it's a mentality like that, where everything is perfect in the perfect world of Truman. It's an AI scenario, you know, where this guy is living from the time he was born in this TV show. That's the perfect world of an AI nutcase fanatic psycho. These people are psychologically disturbed. And so they think that you should want to live like that, that that's your perfect life, that if you can just live according to their perfect plan, everything will be perfect. But let's just take the scenario where you get up and, you know, something goes on and there's an accident on the way to work and the Uber gets late. So you miss your hamburger or your breakfast at McDonald's. You arrive at work late. The Uber then arrives late for its next pickup and the whole thing comes apart. That's just a very simple example of how AI breaks down in the perfect world of prediction, etc. Because the world is not perfect. It does not run like the perfect clock. You can go all the way back to Newton, the time of Newton, where they actually talked in terms of clocks, in terms of the universe being the perfect clock. And everything happens on time and in order, and it plays out perfectly. And in a sense, you could think something like that if you had the perfect computer program that put in all of the information in the universe and every atom and its energy levels and everything else, and you knew exactly the physics of how everything worked in the universe, you could calculate the flow of the universe. But then the interesting part here, and this is the clincher, and this is the thing that ultimately all AI systems will fail, is because the human being is not an automaton. A human being has free will. The human being chooses to do things differently than the status quo. The human being has a soul. AI systems do not recognize the fact that you have a soul and free will and can make decisions. Sometimes you make bad decisions. Sometimes you make good decisions. Sometimes, and this is interacting with your soul. And so, like, let's take, for example, music creation. People think, oh, if you just create music, you can create happy music, or you can create music that is melancholy, and you can create all of this music. It's kind of like the boy band era. Remember back a number of decade or two, you had the boy bands, and it was like all of this mass-produced music with shows and lights and things exploding on stage. And they were very talented. These were young kids that were really, really talented. But, you know, finally there was, you would find these bumper stickers. It'd be a circle that would say boy bands and then a line through it, like no boy bands. Because it was all production music. And people don't like that. People like Chuck Berry or the Beatles or, you know, old music or the Beethoven or Mozart, who created music. These were people. And they created music that affected your soul, like the old blues, the Memphis Bayou, the Cajun music, very happy music, etc. This was all created by people and different styles of music, etc. And it's always amazing, being a mathematician, that if you see music, there's eight notes on the scale, and then it repeats, and then it repeats again, and repeats again. So there's only eight notes. And how could, you know, mathematically, with eight notes, you could only write so many songs. Very, very limited number of songs. You could easily calculate how many songs that were different that you could actually create. Yet the human being has created millions and millions and millions of songs in different styles of music and different feelings and different emotions, etc., with eight notes. It's not possible. But the reason it's possible and actually happens, the reason the human beings created the impossible, was because of the human spirit. And I'm out of time here. I got a few seconds left just to remind you, the UPS strike coming up, get your orders in now. The warehouse sale, where we have a big reduction, certain limited stock of MR5 whole house water filters, and the best deal package on sale. Go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, and just go there and get one. That's all I can tell you. Now's the time. If you've been waiting on the fence, don't wait any longer. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.